Hey, this is Script Lock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Max Volkman.
And I'm Nick Volkman. Today we have Kelsey Beecham and Olivia Alexander joining us. And Kelsey is a game writer and narrative designer and has worked on the recently released Outer Wilds with Mobius Digital. She also wrote and provided narrative design on Stormland for Insomniac and wrote the unreleased Tales from the Minus Lab for USC's Interactive Media and Games Division. And Olivia is a scriptwriter and narrative designer currently based at Ubisoft Montreal, where she has worked on Far Cry 5 and Far Cry New Dawn. And before that, she was a scriptwriter at Ubisoft Quebec, where she worked on Assassin's Creed Odyssey and its various DLCs. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So I think we'll start just with how did you both get into the industry? So Olivia, would you like to start first?
Yeah, sure. It was a big reason that I got into the industry was mainly Montreal itself as a city. I started out in theater mostly. I had done, with some artist collectives, I had done like a lot of, and designed and written and participated in a lot of interactive theater. And I knew I wanted to write. I just wasn't really sure in what. And then in the creative writing department at Concordia University, Concordia University itself had a lot of kind of extracurricular programs that were games oriented or games adjacent, to the point where there were people in the English department who wanted to make a game studies program, kind of like you would have a film studies program. And one of the ways that they were doing that was to build up sort of prestige in the kind of courses and classes that you would take about game studies. And there were two courses I took that I can pretty much easily credit with sparking the fire. One was video games and/as theory, and one was video games as literature. And video games as literature is exactly what it sounds like. It's you take games, mostly really brilliant artistic indie games, and kind of analyze them like they are literature. And the other one was more practical. We ended up it was basically sort of challenging the notions of like games theory and what kind of, I guess, like ludological language that human beings use to kind of transfer information from game designer to player to player and things like that. For example, our class had a Minecraft server, and we had assignments to essentially challenge the notion of like kind of traditional game design within the sandbox of our Minecraft server. And what we decided to do was we decided to try and make a game within our Minecraft server that had hard rails in a game that literally facilitated no rails at all. We ended up making kind of a scavenger hunt thing. And all of this is to say, it very much occurred to me, oh, it would be really cool if I could do this for a living. It'd be really cool if I could work with a group and design these interactive narratives in sort of the a more digital space. And by that point, I had very much believed through and through that video games were art. I was taking a course on the graphic novel, and they were asking, are graphic novels art? And I sort of figured anything can be qualified as art to me if it gives you a visceral reaction. And oh, that's absolutely video games. So basically, I tailored the rest of my degree to sort of have these games adjacent courses. And I actually ended up hooking up with this nonprofit organization in Montreal called Pixels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're great. They had a game writing incubator. The idea was you would go to it, and you, by the end of the time period that you were there, you would have at least two pieces that you would be comfortable showing to any kind of recruiter, games-oriented writing pieces. And it was incredibly helpful, and I met someone there who shared with everyone. It wasn't a huge group, it was maybe like eight people, that shared that there was an internship in Quebec City. And of course, everyone in Montreal was like, heck no, I'm not going to go to Quebec City. And I had just finished my degree, and life was a terrifying black spinning pinwheel of the unknown. So I was like, of course, I will pick up my life and I will move to Quebec City. And then I joined Ubisoft, and it was Assassin's Creed Odyssey. And from there, I transferred back to Montreal, and I sort of have been here ever since.
What games were you analyzing in your games as literature class?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Off the top of my head, The Stanley Parable, Papers, Please, Dysphoria with the number 4.
Yeah.
The Stanley Parable was a big one. The professor never picked anything that was too long. Oh, Braid. Braid was something that he wanted us to play through start to finish. A lot of obvious like focus on indie games because they were sort of easier to I imagine to separate into a curriculum. But yeah, it was fantastic. I it was a good combination of like, oh, I've played that game before, and oh, this is really cool. I've never seen it before. It was a really great class. I ended up writing a paper about how Mirror's Edge and Assassin's Creed are both games about parkour, but fundamentally misunderstand the philosophy behind it.
Oh, wow.
I don't actually miss academia at all. I miss writing little argumentative essays. That's all.
And Kelsey, how did you get into the industry?
By accident. I didn't know this was a job you could do for kind of a long time. I grew up making stuff with my older brother, and that is Alex Beecham, who is Outer Wilds creative director. I honestly don't know what the first thing we made together was, but we grew up doing like little projects and stuff, and he thought he was going to go into film. So I was writing like the occasional like film script and helping with stuff with that. And in the meantime, I was studying literature, but also my double major was in this program at my college called professional writing, where it was really just a lot of training to do editorial work. And I ended up, So Alex ended up going, obviously he switched to games from his original major, ended up doing grad school for it. And I went off and started doing editing work, and he needed somebody to punch up a script that was Tales from the Midas Lab. So that's how I kind of got started. And eventually he had to do Outer Wilds, or didn't have to, but his thesis project was Outer Wilds. And it just sounded like such an interesting thing. It was just kind of natural to be like, hey, I would love to work on that with you. So we did that. And then obviously 2015, we saw some success with IGF. It was just at that point, it was just something we were working on, you know, nights and weekends in our spare time while other, you know, a lot of the other devs were working, obviously, game design or game dev jobs. And with IGF, there was some serious interest in it getting brought on by a studio, and that ended up being Mobius Digital, who then brought me on as a contractor. And I kept writing the game, and 2017, I left my publishing job and was full-time on Outer Wilds for a bit. And then the following year, I took a position at Insomniac. So I'm a fairly recent full-time writer, but turns out you can do it as a career. So like, that was cool. Like, that was a fun thing to learn. So I'm kind of learning a lot as I go, but I don't have any formal background in games, just a long-time love of them and a tendency to approach them pretty analytically.
Which is good. That's different than a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from an early age, my brother would do stuff like if we were, you know, discussing a movie and I said I liked it or I didn't like it, he'd want to know why. And I think that really like programmed me early on to be able to dissect my own opinions and be like, well, here's what's working for me. But it's a useful thing to be able to do for sure.
So when did you know you wanted to become like go full-time game writing?
I started entertaining the idea in 2016, and I think a big influence there was I originally, I did a lot of proofreading, I did a lot of like scientific work, scientific publications, that sort of thing. I worked at the Cryogenic Society. That's what I was doing when we won some stuff at IGF, and then not terribly long after that, I ended up leaving that job to work for The Onion, which is, this was in Chicago. I was already in the city, and I did that starting in 2016. And I think that my time at The Onion probably had a lot to do with me saying, okay, I actually like seeing, because I was doing editorial stuff there, and seeing the writers come in every day was kind of, I don't know, it hammered home the idea that like, you can do that every day as a job. That's a thing that people do.
To start work at The Onion in 2016 seems like a huge challenge.
Yeah, so that was a year and a half of my life. I got a second cat.
That tells all you need to know.
Yeah. that was a direct consequence of working there during that period of time. And this is fine because honestly, Spaceman is a great cat and I'm very lucky to have adopted him. So, but yeah, that was a whole thing. Learned a lot about comedy working there. I've always had a kind of an offbeat sense of humor. That probably comes through with Outer Wilds pretty strongly. And working there was really cool in terms of getting an inside look at how some of that worked and how like the structure of comedy happens and that sort of thing. So that was quite cool. And then 2017, by that point, I was kind of like, all right, well, I gotta commit to a career here. And I did end up going ahead and making the switch over because by that point I was doing like all of my time off was going to GDC or, going out to LA to work on site at the studio for a while because I was doing this remotely with Mobius Digital. And then by 2017, I signed a contract to do some full-time on-site work with them. And that kept going through by like mid-2017 into 2018. And by that point, I was like actually applying to, see, like, my partner's going to listen to this later and be like, oh yeah, you're saying it like it was just a natural thing that happened. But there was a lot of him being like, you should do this. You enjoy it. You're good at it. You really should do this.
That's awesome.
Support. Yeah, he's really supportive. Mm-hmm. I'm very lucky. But and then I ended up taking a contract with Insomniac's North Carolina office and moving to Durham, which is where I am right now. And then since that ended, I've been doing contracting work since shorter term stuff for a couple of different studios, kind of looking for my next full time project. But yeah, it just kind of, this is a thing that happened. And I grew up writing and loving writing and always just kind of dabbling in different projects that interested me, different types of storytelling. And ultimately, this is the one that I'm most interested in, that I really love, just the player agency involved as a component of storytelling. And it's ruined me for other work. Like, I can't go back to publishing now. Jeez.
So, since both of you like have a background in non-linear storytelling, and we're probably going to focus on that a lot in this episode, what would each of you say is the hardest part about working with non-linear storytelling for each of you?
Do you want to go first? Or
I could.
I'm not stalling.
No. Well, for me, non-linear, the biggest, and this is also a perspective that's very much a coming from the AAA side of things, but the biggest limitation I think would be budgeting and line count. Because most AAA games involve voice acting and recording, and that's not an inexpensive process. So if you think about maybe Dragon Age Origins, where it has a protagonist that doesn't speak, you can have all sorts of responses to someone in dialogue that can be cutting or witty or sort of these reactions that maybe like 8 reactions on the screen or something. And maybe there's some sneaky design going on behind the scenes where 2 of them actually lead to the same response from the NPC you're talking to, things like that. Little things like that to save on lines is very understandable. But when there's so many responses that the player can have when there's no voice that needs to be recorded for it, there's a lot more leeway. When you're in something where every, with the exception of, any content that's read instead of spoken, almost every word that you write has to be recorded by someone else, every word you write becomes very expensive. And then by necessity, a lot of the framework around you would prefer that you used less words. And I don't know, I think it was Hemingway or something who said, you don't pay me to write, you pay me to edit. And sure, that's absolutely true. I will always be writing something out and constantly cutting it back and cutting it back and cutting it back. And eventually, it's sometimes difficult to explain to others that if I cut this back anymore, you will have a emotionless robot speaking to you. And I think it is better to have the challenge, all of this is to say, the challenge is getting as much nuance, characterization, and vital gameplay information to the character, to the player, in as few words as possible.
I kind of like the motto, edit with a machete first and then a scalpel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's true regardless of, I've done both at this point, I've done both VO and not that. I'm not even sure what to call that now. Just text only. And obviously it really impacts just your writing style tremendously to have to factor in an actor. And I think it's fascinating the way that having a voice actor and reading and performing a line can make or break it. Like you can write things that would work super well if it for a text only game, but for voiceover, it's like, oh no, that's actually really awkward. Or you write a line that you're like, oh, this isn't, you know, I'm not thrilled with this, but maybe they can sell it. And then your actor just nails it. And you're like, oh, cool. that's going to sound amazing actually. So.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And people often say that the process of, you know, writing, recording, stuff like that, the pipeline is different from studio to studio. It's also different from project to project, I've noticed, because on Far Cry, I was in the booth with the voice actors, and it was really, really handy. And I didn't have to speak up much. It was only little things, like if the voice director was mistaken about one thing or another, I would speak up. But besides that, I didn't really say much. And the policy on the project I'm on now is very much not that. It's very unlikely that the writers will get in the booth at all. And this is,
oh wow,
it is a little bit, especially someone who comes from a very sort of more distantly these days, a theater background, it's a lot of to cut something down as much as possible and then have faith enough that the actor will take it and run with it correctly, while also at the same time trying to juggle nuances with what you're writing is nerve-wracking. But also, as a wise friend once told me, at the end of the day, it don't matter. None of it matters.
Just video games.
Yeah. Eventually, oh, God. I know, right? Eventually, you wrote a thing as absolutely best you could, and if somebody fumbles the ball down the line, At the end of the day, you wrote a thing as best you could. So,
yeah. Who knows? Maybe it'll be better.
Yeah, yeah. There's also that possibility. That is hugely optimistic, and I appreciate it very much.
What were you going to say, Kelsey?
Oh, no, just obviously everyone wants to feel that their work is really important, and I love what I do. I love getting to tell stories in an interactive medium in this really cool, I mean, it's still in its infancy, really, and that's so, so fun. But also, I'm like what I'm like. So I definitely stress over it too much. And it's good just to remember, like, it's not, you know, you're not saving lives here. This is, you know, it's important work and you love doing it, but it's not, you know, maybe don't hurt yourself. And I laughed when you said it, just because when I was younger, I ended up briefly in the emergency room for like stabbing chest pains. And my partner was like, low-key thought I was dying, I think. And they talked to me about it and they're like, oh, that's probably just stress actually. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, glad I'm not dying. Always happy to hear that. And they're like, oh, okay, no. Well, like, do you have a stressful job? And I'm like, yeah. I don't want to admit it.
Are you like a ER nurse? Or
yeah, it's this, like, this ER doctor asking me,
immigration
lawyer? What's your job that it's so stressful? And I'm like, I write video games for a living. Oh, no. And the look he gave me, like, I just felt that in my soul. Like, it's still there. Like, that's who's looking at me some days when I'm stressing out about getting something exactly perfect. It's that ER doctor looking at me like, are you serious, dude?
So is the hardest part about nonlinear storytelling for you the stress of it?
No, I think that's a me thing more than a games thing. Not stressful, but like,
it's not just a you thing.
it's definitely not just a me thing, but like, you know, some people react very physically to stress. And as I've gotten older, I've learned I'm one of those people. So it was just a matter of kind of figuring out, okay, like, let's take de-stressing more seriously. A lot of meditation, a lot of exercise, that sort of thing. Just like making time to have a work-life balance. Because sometimes I go like all in on things because you get excited. But then you're like, oh, right. Like when I was writing this game, you know, Outer Wilds, when I was writing it part-time and also working a full-time job every now and then, I was like, what am I doing with my life? This isn't sustainable. So very happy to be not doing that anymore. But The probably the most challenging aspect to me of a nonlinear story is creating a narrative experience for the player for each possible order for the playthrough to happen. You know what I mean? And making that a really enjoyable narrative experience, regardless of how it in what order it's played. That can be really difficult. And there's a lot of narrative design that goes into, like, there's not an equal weight. There's for each possible piece of text you can find in Outer Wilds. It's not equally likely you're going to find each one first. We've staged things pretty carefully. We had different levels of, you know, sensitivity of information, and we put them in different places accordingly. Surface level text, we put, like, you know, literally on the surface of planets and whatnot. And those are all good, like, initial mystery points that don't, like, quote unquote, spoil the ending, so to speak. You're not going to get the answers right away from those. But at a certain point, you do have to kind of let go of the idea of having control of how that narrative is precisely experienced. And ultimately, it kind of just boils down to playtesting the hell out of it, which obviously when you're early in the story and early in your iterations of it, it's much harder to gauge, partly because there's not as much of it there. Like, it's harder to test it when it's not all, you know, in place, but also because I feel like a lot of the heavier playtesting is obviously happening toward the end of production. And at that point, you have a lot of story locked into place. So that can be a little nerve-wracking where you're like, wow, I really hope this works and we don't have to frantically rewrite it. But, you know, you do what you have to.
Totally. And I wanted to backtrack quick before I forget to Olivia mentioned about talking about self-editing. Would both of you say, are you good at self-editing or do you rely on others to help with editing?
Six of one. Six of one, half dozen of the other. Personally, I think over the years I've gotten a lot better at it. One thing growing up with theater helped is being able to kind of take direction and, like, not take it personally. And once you're able to take criticism from other people about your work and not take it personally, you're able to detach yourself enough to do the same from you to you. Does that make sense? The idea that I can look at my work and be like, I really like this line, but you know, you know.
The old murder your darlings.
Exactly.
Stab them up.
That being said, even to this day, sometimes I see one of those darlings and I'm like, but you're just so nice. So I call in a friend to look at it and they're like, it's not that nice. And I'm like, okay. And then all I need is someone else to tell me to kill the darling and then I will kill it. But for the most part, I think I'm okay. What about you, Kelsey?
I love feedback, honestly. But not to the extent that it doesn't, like, change my own opinion of the work usually super drastically. Usually it's more of I like having a second opinion, being like, yeah, I'm getting this from it. Or, you know, giving it to somebody and hearing, like, hey, it's coming. Okay, so, like, here's my take on this character. Here's how they're coming across. And I'm like, oh, that's not quite how I wanted that to work. I should tweak it. So, yeah, I guess a little half and half. I'm really comfortable editing my own work, especially if I I don't know if you do this. I have to kind of set it aside. Like, the writing happens, and I'm filling things out, and I honestly, the thing I love most about writing drafts is putting just, like, in brackets, like, just garbage text where you're like, this is the point I have to convey here.
Yeah.
And, yep. You know, just the barest bones, and you put the meat on that later. But I'm better at editing if I, like, actually kind of stop writing and then go through it and I make notes for myself and then I go back and tweak it to those specifications. Because otherwise I'll get trapped in an endless loop of trying to tweak one sentence to be perfect. And then look up and I'm like, you know, 30 minutes later and I'm like, oh, this is a mistake. So it's a little easier to get, it's definitely easier to get feedback from someone on the team so that you know how things are coming across from an outside perspective, because that's who's obviously going to be experiencing the game. But at the same time, yeah, you know, got to be confident in what you're writing, I suppose. And no one's going to be harder on my own work than me. I don't think that's possible. So I just, yeah, I don't know. I guess I really don't mind feedback unless, oh God, except I don't know if you do this, Olivia, and this is so bad. I really hate when someone gives me feedback that I just 1000% agree with. And I'm like screaming in my head while they're reading it. I'm like, oh, I know this part's not good yet. And they give you that feedback and you're like, yeah, no, you're right. It's a problem.
For me, I at least learned to be like, okay, just wait till they're done talking and then say, yes, I know. And then just move on.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just
that's
sort of
the best you can do. Because otherwise you go down a path of, you know, yeah, and here's why it's terrible. And like, yeah, that's not helpful.
Oh, goodness. The greatest lesson I ever learned was that if you have to explain something, then it didn't come across. Like, you can explain something in that, oh, well, this is what I tried to do.
Or like, it's going to connect into thing later.
Yeah, it's gonna connect into thing later, or if you didn't even plan for it to connect into thing later and it just bears explaining, then that means you didn't execute it properly and you've got to go back and fix it. I used to make the mistake when I was younger of being like, no, you fool. Don't you see that this is what I was going for and clearly you just missed it. No, if the person didn't understand something, then you got to go back and make sure that,
right,
that they do.
I do love when somebody comes to me and they're like, hey, all right, here's my take on this. Here's what I got from it. And it's just something that you weren't at all expecting.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of love that when somebody kind of jolts you out of your normal editing approach or even if they just come to you with like, hey, what if this connected into, you know, what we're doing over here with gameplay or with the visuals for this particular like weapon type or whatever it is. I get excited, man. It's hard not to get too excited at people sometimes and then like go off the rails. But sometimes I have a hard time with self-editing, with leaving myself too many notes. Mm-hmm. And then I have to like go back through and resolve them before I get like the draft to somebody. Because one thing I did learn early on is that if you come to somebody saying like, here it is, it's not very good yet, it's real bad, you know, I hate it. Maybe not that extreme. But, you know, if you're coming and being negative about it, I think people have a tendency to reply in very guarded ways, in ways that maybe aren't as brutally honest as you need them to.
Mm-hmm. Because they're already you like, already feel bad and they yeah. don't want to step on you or something.
Like they're not going to come back like, yeah, this is garbage. What have you done? Well,
the real ones will, you know, like your true forever buds will definitely be like, you're absolutely right. This is trash.
I love that your theater background has kind of prepared you for harsh criticism. And if anything, I think, or like, you know, just blunt feedback, I guess I should say, not harsh criticism. That would be weird if you were working at a studio where they're like, by the way.
I genuinely think it's along the lines of, I think the way I subconsciously internalized it was, if I am in my entire physicality, standing on a like a literal stage in front of someone else, and they're like, what you're doing with your body and your voice and your face is wrong, and I can go, okay, I'm not going to take that personally, and I'm just going to fix it now.
Hard not to take your face is wrong slightly personally.
If I can take that, then I can definitely take, hey, this thing you wrote on a paper is wrong.
Yeah. Like,
if it's all smooth sailing from here.
I think coming from the other side of the equation helps as have someone who has been an editor. And I kind of, like, one thing we did learn there was giving feedback in a way that was very easy to digest and was very much, you know, the kind of attitude there is always, we're working together to make this the best it possibly can be while retaining the, like, the voice and the purpose and everything, and like making sure that message comes across incredibly clearly. So it's kind of almost hard to take it personally at this point, just because I know everyone has the game's best interests at heart. And maybe also because I worked with my brother and occasionally we would forget to pull our punches, so to speak, and just be brutally honest with each other. And God bless our lead designer. Lone Verneau is a treasure of a human being. He's brilliant, and that's irritating. And no. do you know any of those people where you're just like, they're so, so smart in such interesting
absolutely.
Ways? And he's always like, no, but like, but you're like smart and wonderful as a human being because you have your own like unique, you know, for this and this reason. And like, he genuinely means it every time. Like,
oh, you're kind too. God damn it.
Yeah, yeah. He's too good. And it's sometimes it's just like, Lone, just be less good for like 5 minutes.
Have one flaw.
Just one bois would be great. And he's going to hear this later and be like, no, bois, bois, Nigel. And he'll mean it too. So he's also humble, the bastard. but every now and then, Loewen would step in and be like, hey, so like you really like tore this part down, but like you like the direction it's going in, right? And one of us would be like, oh, yeah, no. Like his or her idea is brilliant. Like we absolutely should do that. We just have to fix this one part of it, whether that was like a design thing or a story thing. So it was really helpful, I think, to have somebody there being like, hey, don't you're slipping into the sibling role instead of the, you know, professional coworker role.
And to backtrack like a minute, you're talking about giving feedback. How do you give good feedback? Or another way, like, what is bad feedback?
I'm a big believer. And if someone were to come up to me and say that what I'm about to say is you know, childish or kid gloves or whatever, they can fight me, meet me at the pit. But
spicy, I'll back you up.
I'm a big believer in the sandwich where you say something positive first. Basically, it lets the person know that what you are doing in general has merit to it. Maybe this person is a veteran and doesn't really need that assurance, but I consider it good form. And then it's a shit sandwich. So if I can say, can I cuss in this podcast?
Yes, yes.
Okay, totally. Thank God.
It's a shit sandwich, and then you say the shit in the middle of the sandwich. You're like, this is where it has merit, and this is where it's not working out for me. And this can be as harsh as you want, or not as harsh, but like as detailed and maybe an expansive a list as you want, at least when you're talking to me. But at least at the end of the list, if you go like, hey, I know that was a lot, but remember, and then you reestablish maybe something you said before or something else that is like something good that reestablishes like, hey, here's all the work you have to do, but remember, you have merit. And again, maybe this is like left over from being a student, and maybe professionals don't need the same reassurance that students do, but I, as a professional to this day, still consider it a courtesy and definitely give it to, I use it when editing other people's work.
Oh, I absolutely use that. Yeah. Not just because, I mean, I think it's easy to, for other people to maybe downplay it as kid gloves or whatever, but honestly, I find it incredibly useful to know what's working for people. Mm-hmm. We took ages trying for me to find the, you know, I tried so many different things trying to find the right tone for, we have in the Outer Wilds, these ancient aliens called the Nomai. And I wanted them to not fall into that, you know, ancient alien trope. And for that to happen, I was trying to find a really good tone that was still kind of alien, but still human in a lot of, you know, important ways. And it just took a lot. So when I heard things like, hey, this line really works, I really like this direction, that was super useful because it was like, okay, we're getting some, you know, we're picking up steam here. This is kind of coalescing into something. I guess I would just say bad feedback is probably feedback that doesn't try to maybe understand what the author is doing.
Oh, yeah, I didn't answer that part of the question, but yeah, absolutely.
I would argue a non-sandwich feedback, that's all shit, would be probably poor form as well, but...
mm-hmm. It would kind of imply that, like, I guess that your editor or maybe whoever is giving you feedback doesn't necessarily... Yeah, like, they don't want to see what's good, they only are relishing, maybe that's the wrong word, in what is bad. And like, that's only constructive to a point.
So I think next, Olivia, you had mentioned this offline about stuff you want to talk about. We're talking about nonlinear storytelling, and you were interested in framing it around a murder mystery. So when you are designing a story, how do you quantify values that are hard to quantify? Like allocating quantitative values to clues that are traits of characters or emotional responses is what you had brought up.
I love this question, by the way.
Well, I was thinking about it a lot, and I've kind of thought about it, like, for a long time. Like, way back, I had this job with, like, this summer arts collective, and what we would do is we'd put on kind of these day-long interactive experiences, mainly for, like, kids and teenagers. But instead of, if you want, I sort of didn't even realize at this point, I didn't realize I wanted to write for games. When I was sort of making these and designing these with people, I I knew vaguely that the format was similar to a video game, but it was sort of like quest givers or NPCs were the actors, and you know, the player would be all the kids running around talking to these different actors and talking to different people and gathering intel to try and solve a murder mystery. And the crime, just to be clear, since these were at the time with children, it wasn't actually like murder. I would use the term murder mystery as like sort of a shorthand for an alliterative shorthand for investigate the crime, talk to people and investigate the crime. And the way I would sort of quantify it with actors is basically only give them this piece of information if they get your character angry, or only give them this piece of information if you know that they've talked to that actor over there who plays your ex or something like that. I find that it was a little, not easier, but more intuitive to do it, to sort of design the importance of what clues the kind of, I guess, the interactive audience member would have to sort of go for and search for when it's kind of the context of the human aspect is involved, when you see right in front of you what everything looks like, sounds like, feels like. That's not always available to you in the middle of game production. Oftentimes, no. Art assets and things like that. So if we're going to use the theater metaphor, the set and the costumes and things like that are not ready until the very end. Actually, that is kind of similar to to theater. But when you're in a game, everything is obviously quantified in a digital way, each clue is quantified with kind of a Boolean variable that's either true or false. I hope I haven't lost anyone here, but
still there. You got me.
Yeah. So it's easy to kind of just be like, here's a big list of clues. You can either find them or not find them. But the thing is, it's different. Finding a red herring will have a very different quantitative value to what you as the designer can definitively say the player knows, as opposed to finding the murder weapon.
That's a great phrase. I am sorry, I'm kind of interrupting you, but what you can definitively say the player knows is actually something we had to kind of go through with Outer Wilds. That was a big thing, because it is essentially a big narrative mystery game, despite being very, you know, exploration, action-adventure-based. Well, adventure, I should say. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Action always implies, like, guns to me. I don't know why.
Well, you're not wrong. I think a lot of people in the industry use it as, like, a synonym for combat.
It's a very particular type of shorthand. But mm-hmm. just, yeah, it's... Even if what you're trying to quantify is just, does the player understand, like, okay, let's say they've gotten these three clues, but are they actually able to put those together, and, you know, do they like actually comprehend what that means, and if so, like, how do you verify that for sure?
Mm-hmm.
and without necessarily always... requiring, like, you have to go here and do the thing,
yeah, like without beating them over the head with it. And one thing, when I was writing short fiction, and then when I moved more to interactive writing of any kind, is that I would always, I used to get feedback about, like, oh, you've made this too obvious. Like, oh, the lead that you're trying to bury, you're putting it in the face of the reader or the player. So basically all this is to say, I would so much rather not assume, I would rather assume the player is smart.
Thank you.
Yeah, but then, you know, I, at least in my experience, there's playtests and things like that, and things that you think are very evident are not, like, and that's one of the beauties of feedback and playtests and things like that. And
yeah, the player is always, like, you know, they're never stupid when you want them to be stupid, basically.
Yeah.
It's a mean way to say it. I don't mean it in a mean way at all. I just, you know, I've played games where I've been running around and, you know, after like way too long, I'm like, oh, this is what they're doing. I get it now.
And, but the thing is, for example, I played The Last Guardian not too long ago, and it had been out for a while. And this is by the same people who made Ico and Shadow of the Colossus. They did not give a single crap about guiding the player by the hand anywhere. So many times in The Last Guardian, I was at a loss as to how to progress forward. I had to look up a walkthrough a bunch of times. But you know what? I admired the shit out of them because they were like, no, we're not going to guide you from place to place. We'll give you some hints with a voiceover, but we're not going to make it easy for you because this is a game that's supposed to be challenging.
One thing that I love when games do that, but a really hard thing with that is kind of just accessibility for a good variety of players, because then you get players where you're like, okay, obviously you have to, you know, this game is going to be really hard. But there was a certain level of difficulty that we were kind of going for with Outer Wilds that we actually, I feel like we maybe scaled back just a little on that, because otherwise it was going to be so difficult that, you know, we're already an indie game. We're not going to have necessarily the biggest audience to begin with. And if we're like viciously cutting down, you know, who's able to play the game, that's problematic too. And there's not always an easy... The obvious solution would be a hint system that you can opt into, or, you know, something comparable, but it's just not always an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I liked the way they did it in, I don't know if they did this in multiple Uncharted games or just one of them.
Oh, with
where
the...
Sorry. You can ask for a hint. Yeah, no worries.
I got excited.
You get a little glowing, like, push the D-pad button to be like, if you want a hint. And you can also be like, shut up, I don't want a hint. And then you're and then you're fine.
Yeah.
And just to add one more tip system that I thought was pretty good, or surprisingly good, was the remake of Link's Awakening. And this is in the original game, too. Just, like, there are buildings you can go to where there's a phone in the middle of the room. And you just pick up this phone, and then the guy gives you a hint for what you're supposed to do next.
And that's in the remake?
Yeah. And it works in universe.
That's very sweet. I like that.
Yeah. It's just a little, weird little town. And then you talk to this guy. He's really happy. And then it fits in lore where just
no,
fits
that's
the world
really
they're
cool
experiencing. Yeah.
To have, he's like delighted to help.
Yeah. If you go try to talk to him in person, he's like shy, doesn't want to talk to you. But if you go talk to him on the phone, he's like, hey, you want to do this? Yeah, you should probably go do that.
That's kind of a great way to have a hint system that I think a lot of people don't like pressing anything that says hint. I'm definitely like that.
Yeah, like if it's not in the HUD, if you can actively just walk over and do it physically.
So maybe integrating it with the narrative in that way is a more satisfying thing to do, because then at least you're making some really shy dude who only communicates via phone happy because he actually gets to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
That's kind of good.
It's the cutest.
And I also wanted to, or Kelsey, you have not answered, how do you quantify values? Values are hard to quantify.
Ooh, how indeed. that is a really tough one. One of the things that came up a lot with Outer Wilds is we populate your ship log with certain things that you've discovered as you've gone around reading and interacting with the found text in the game. And there's just a ton of found text because essentially this is a game about alien archaeology and kind of discovering this story that happened in the past. And then, spoiler alert, maybe continuing it a little. Who knows? Who can say? And one thing was, you know, at what point do you consider the text read? Because I don't know if you guys are familiar with how that found text works, but it's a whole system with, there's a text tool that you use where you point it at a segment of the alien text and you hold A to scan it and it'll, you know, translate it for you. And that is a piece by piece thing. And all of the found text is dialogues between different characters, because I really don't like reading giant histories that are like in books and games. You'd think I would, but I don't. I'm not always into that because, you know, I'm busy. I've got adventuring to do. I don't want to sit down and read like a nerd. So, sorry. This is a bit much, do you think? A bit much?
No, it's fine. I studied literature. It's not everyone's cup of tea, to be sure.
But the thing beyond that, it's not a linear conversation system. It's the text physically exists in the world to scan it, and because of that, I took some liberties with how it's how it works as a language, and it all kind of, it'll branch off from the main idea, and you'll start like separate conversations. So you'll have this main conversational thread with all of these branching bits that go to talk about related things, or that branch to make a pun about science, or that branch to be like, oh, as an aside to this character, by the way, blah, blah, blah. So there are all of these elements, and it's kind of like you have to figure out what the core important thing is. And for us, what we ended up doing was, so each piece of found text has to do something insanely specific. And for how much text is in Outer Wilds, it was really a masterclass in word economy. Mm-hmm. You just can't make people read for that long. Having the text tool shockingly helped.
Can't I?
Won't you?
Challenge accepted.
Oh, God. I would love it if you were just behind somebody in their house playing a while they're playing your game, just being like, you read all of that text. You enjoy that. You savor it. You are pressing A too fast. Slow down that text speed. No, but...
Read a comprehension test.
Yeah, the dream, I suppose, is just Banjo-Kazooie. Final, whatever that quiz thing is, where you have to get all the questions right.
Yeah.
That is not the dream. I am joking. In case that wasn't clear. But we kind of, whenever I was writing these things, I knew what my baseline was for, like, this is the piece of information I'm trying to get in there. So there was this core idea that had to be conveyed, and it had to direct the player toward the next piece of that storyline, because there are a lot of different threads to it. So there had to be something in there that moved the thread forward, that progressed it chronologically to the next piece of information. And then there also had to be, usually there was a piece that, because you don't know what order anyone's going to find this in, it also goes back in time to the previous location in that story, where the, you know, the previous bit of found text leading into this would be found if you needed to go backward to figure that out. And then it goes on to like tie in other storylines, that kind of thing. And then obviously beyond all that and beyond progressing the story, but it also has to be entertaining, because nobody wants to read a bunch of like dry space alien language and be really bored about it the whole time. It's not a fun game. So basically, knowing that I needed this core piece of information to come out, there was a certain level of, okay, we have to make it this level of clear. And then for the board that we, there's kind of a, okay, I keep calling these murder boards, and apparently that's weird. Is that
Are you
a
talking
thing?
About like a red string?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I mean, like
Charlie Day in the Mailroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people call that the red string meme these days. But if you were to say murder board, I think I would know what you mean.
I'm like slightly uncomfortable with how many times people have sent me that picture in relation to my work. Not just in Outer Wilds either. I don't know how to, like, Insomniac.
Oh,
and, like,
my goodness. Kelsey, you should absolutely take that as a compliment.
I do.
People think you're concocting a very complex thing.
I love it, but also I look into Charlie Day's face and I'm like, oh, man, that is an unhinged human being. And the thing is, I love stories. I kind of adopted John Piquette, who was the lead writer at Insomniac, likes to say simple story, complex character. And I'm really into that. So the story needs to be simple enough that you're following it, obviously, and you're getting what that base nugget of information is. It's basically just factually, here is the thing that I found. And kind of there's an amount of just saying, okay, you as the player have to kind of connect the dots, but we'll put them on this board for you in your ship, so you can look at them. We'll record like where it told you to go and where like the previous, like what it, where it connects into the rest of the story, where you would find more information about this particular thing. But there is kind of a leap of logic that you have to let the player make. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I think as a result, there's this really strong kind of player community that exists, and it's, you know, it's small, we're an indie game, but like, I love them because they're so careful about not spoiling things for each other, but like cautiously guiding them in the right direction. And it's just really wonderful to see. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think some degree of it is you put the stuff out there in an open world, and you, once the player has put one and one together, then they know kind of what location or who they have to go to then talk about thing two that they've deduced, if that makes sense.
I think it does. I think it does answer it. And also, we had a write-in question from previous guest Ben Arfman asking about how you, basically everything you just talked about with the Nomai and the written language. Olivia, like when you're working in Branching Narratives, how do you track all that? And Kelsey, how do you track everything on like Outer Wilds?
Wait, was this something he wrote in recently?
Yeah, like today.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Ben's delightful. I know you've had him on in the past. I would have recommended him if you hadn't.
He recommended you, and then
oh,
you gave him a heads up, and then like, oh, okay, ask her about this.
Oh, geez. I'm like, I actually kind of like, whoa, such a sweetheart. But I feel like I've been talking a lot, so Olivia, oh, do sure. you want to take it? Or
sorry, the question was...
when you're doing work with Branching Narratives, how do you track basically all the permutations?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. So I got pretty prolific with a program called Twine, which I imagine you guys are familiar with on this podcast.
Yes.
I write conversations in there all the time.
Oh, it is.
Before I put them in XML, yeah.
Phenomenal. For anyone listening who doesn't know what it is an open source, free online branching narrative tool. If you know, all you need to know is the basic, most basic of HTML coding, and you can absolutely make your own branching narrative. So what I did on my most recent project, when I was sort of crafting a lot of these different conversations, is I would make prototypes in Twine and then, present them to the team, to directors, level design directors, things like that. Because for some reason, whenever I explained, no, this will be good, take my word for it, they didn't really take my word for it. So I would make these, prototypes, and I would make them sort of these interactive presentations wherein people would decide what to do, and then I would show them the back end, so to speak, of what the inside of Twine looked like. And basically, when I am able to use a tool like Twine and literally put the variables that I need in the same place as the text that is attached to them, it's very, very handy. What I ended up doing, it all depends on how your game is made, but if you have a database or a tool that is separate from your game engine, then it's very likely that you will not be able to make your own variables in the dialogue tool yourself. So chances are you and your wonderful, trusty level designer will have to sit down with each other and say, okay, when the player hears this dialogue, this variable is set to true. And essentially, it's a collaborative effort between you and your level designer to make sure that the things that you want the player to know happen when you want them to happen. That's very specific to like the tools and things that I'm using.
Oh no, actually, it's something that we did as well. I can definitely say Outer Wilds did that, where I would set certain conditions, like certain things had to be explored, or certain people have certain conversations had to have been read or had. It's I think that's pretty widespread for the most part. Mm-hmm. Just maybe the actual like deployment of it varies from studio to studio for sure.
Mm-hmm. Usually, no matter what though, whether it's just me or it's me telling a level designer something, I'll make a list. I make a list of all the variables that I need. And generally that is also a handy dandy finite list of clues that the player can find.
Do you know, actually this kind of brings to mind, there was a presentation, oh gosh, who did this? It was at who's responsible for this? GDC this past year, somebody did a really interesting presentation on how their text tools work. Was that Naughty Dog?
Was it Obsidian?
Oh, yep, that's who it was. It was Obsidian. Cheers. Should have remembered that, especially because I've gotten to meet some Obsidian people lately for how frequently people mistake Outer Wilds for The Outer Worlds. So, we're friendly. they have this phenomenal talk that where they kind of broke down their, bespoke dialogue system where they have all of these different variables. And the thing I love about it is that you can search really easily by independent variable and see like, okay, for this RPG, am I requiring too many power checks or checks to charisma or whatever to, Should I be using this other stat more often? Is that not balanced enough?
That sounds like a dream.
It's so dreamy. it's pretty custom too. Just like, go watch this talk. Oh my God. I wish I could remember the name of it off the top of my head, but you'll find it. It's tremendous.
Carrie Patel is one of the speakers in it. I know that. I can't remember the other guy.
It's probably right here in my notebook. Speaking of lists, technical tools for authoring branching dialogue. That's what it's called. Carrie Patel, David. Oh dear. Sorry, David. Simizic? There's
we'll
no vowels
the
except
notes.
Y's. Tech director is his title. So
yeah,
that's probably more useful than me butchering the pronunciation. Very sorry if he ever hears this. Sorry. I got my money's worth out of like Excel, Google spreadsheets. I have, just a pathological number of spreadsheets that exist for keeping track of various conditions. And I don't know, I find it really useful for like, when we started Outer Wilds, we were like, the story is going to be about Yay. You know, here's about what we'll need for it. Here's our key like points of interest. Great. And we kind of just went with it. I keep a lot of notes because I don't always have the greatest memory for certain things. So I like to write a lot of things down. It just helps me remember stuff anyway. And we kind of got, even when the studio picked it up in 2015, we thought my role as for the writing was going to be just, you know, not nearly that long, certainly not years. and so that wasn't the most organized thing. So we eventually, my brother and I sat down and we were like, okay, we got to sort this out into a better Excel doc than the one that exists currently, because it's kind of insane to reference. And we color coded things by like, you know, planet and stuff, where you're finding the information, where it's directing you, what it's going to appear under in the ship log, what characters are associated with which topics, that kind of thing. That was some of these were more like my domain, especially things like keeping track of, you know, characters involved in certain conversations, just because I was kind of coding those to be, if a particular character was involved, that means a particular like location is involved, or a particular like theme or like, you know, subplot was happening. And I doubt anyone really cross-referenced that, but every now and then someone would be like, this is the character from like the Black Hole Forge. And so they know that the Forge is involved in whatever story thing is happening. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, we had to kind of comb it out into four distinct threads, and they all kind of eventually come together at the end. Or they can. You can finish the game in a couple of different states. It's you know, it's a thing. Well, we don't want to require everyone to like check everything off a particular list of to-do things. So there are entire things that you like places you don't even have to go to if you don't want to. Like, screw it. And besides the extensive Excel sheets and all the version control I was doing, because that's kind of a leftover, I think, from being an editor, that I'm a little intense about version control. I'm always like, but what if I need the version of this document from 4 years ago that was...
Oh, those thoughts are demons.
I know. I need to like KonMari my online documents, frankly, all of my digital stuff, because it's a lot. Even if it is aggressively organized. The other thing I did personally, I'm a big fan of whiteboards. I also kind of like, I literally had a physical murder board of like locations and plot threads and things in my home office that I would reference all the time. And it was just really useful having that physical item in front of me.
But a physical reference. Yeah.
It's weirdly important to me as somebody who works with a digital medium, but I'm like that with calendars too. I can't keep track of my life with like an app. People are always recommending me apps to control my business. And I'm like, just like my life business, I'm, you know, and I can't, it doesn't, nothing works. But I bullet journal like a fiend,
man. I have so many stuff I want to get into, but Olivia, you mentioned a while back about player assumptions when it comes to knowledge of the story. And Kelsey, you wanted to talk about what assumptions do you think a game story should and should not make in regards to player knowledge. So I'd love to hear both your thoughts on that.
We'll just solve that real quick.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, it's obviously going to be dependent on what context the game has already set out. Because on the one hand, sometimes when I get bogged down, I try to give myself a bit of a God's eye view and think, if you were Clouseau, Holmes, Nancy Drew, whatever, and you were thrust by some whatever omnipotent force of fate into this mystery scenario, you wouldn't have a HUD. You wouldn't have, you know, tooltips or helper text or whatever. You would have the information and your own brain. And I think there is, at a certain point, a bit of a romance to the idea that that's what the player has. They also have extra help from, like, the medium of the video game itself. But the idea is that I, as a writer, and my team as designers, will give the player, will put in this box everything that they need. It is up to the player to both find and put it together. And that is where the kind of the ludological joy of a mystery comes in. It's very much a Jesus take the wheel situation. But
no, that, and again, that's really eloquently said. Well done. I really agree with that.
But yeah, that is not to say that, like, you know, I don't believe in helper text, blah, blah, blah. No. That's not at all the person I am. I'm very much believe that games should be fun. And that if it's too, there is a point where something can be too challenging so that it's not fun anymore. But I do think that that gap has to be jumped across by the player and that we can't bridge it for them.
Yeah, I think there has to be a certain amount of people being comfortable with just the idea that you can't spoon feed the player things, and you have to be comfortable with kind of, I think I said this earlier about just nonlinear experiences as a whole, that you have to accept that players are going to go do weird things and go places they maybe ideally shouldn't, or that they're going to experience something out of order. And you have to, you know, that's your job, is you have to account for those possibilities and make them still satisfying. And even then, it's still a matter of, it's not a matter of, you know, personally, I think it's better to account for something narratively, like the possibility narratively in an open world setting, where if your player makes a left turn on you, that it still works in terms of the story, versus like having to just aggressively design around it or like change the level or whatever. And it's not to say that that doesn't come in, you know, handy. I'm sorry, I'm like going off on a tangent here.
No, this is good.
The too long did not read version is that you just kind of have to be comfortable with the idea that your player is going to have to make some leaps, and you're going to have to go a little more hands-off with them and let them fail. Like, let your player struggle a little.
Make it okay if they fail. Like, don't make them feel bad, yeah. I guess.
I mean, I literally just made, well, not just made, but recently, I guess, made a game where death is not a fail state at all. Well, okay, like technically once, but that's a joke. It's not important. But yeah, just letting your player have room to fail a little bit and giving them space to struggle without, you know, torturing them over it. I think that's, like with The Last Guardian, that just has to be part of games for me. I'm not really interested in making games that are spoon-feeding stuff to people where the challenge is only there in the combat or in the, you know, the platforming or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So do both of you, would you say that you prefer giving players more leeway when it comes to understanding the world and the story, or that you'd prefer to give them more so that it's a higher chance of them understanding more and maybe over-explaining things?
I think it's good if you can give them the tools to understand things more in depth if they need them, but go hands off where possible. Just because I've talked about this before, but I'm very pro, I don't like to push information onto players. I prefer to let players pull that information from the game as needed. And I think it's probably true that a player is going to remember something more if they sought it out themselves and they were trying to understand how something worked out of curiosity, as opposed to because the game says it's tutorial time. Even boy, I know I keep talking about Outer Wilds, but that's the one I can talk about right now.
Yeah.
So that's the tutorial area there is the only thing you have to do is go get the launch codes and take off. That's it. We provide all of these tools. There's an entire museum in the game. I freaking love museums in games. So that was a lot of fun to get to finally do one. But there are all these things that are there in the museum that most players don't spend too much time on because they're like, cool, this is interesting information, but it's probably not, you know, important. I got to go take off. I got to go to space. Like, I'm busy. And I love this happened a lot with playtesting. I love it every single time the players come back in there and they're like, oh, this actually has useful information about the world that's going to help me understand how to do things without outright telling me how. I the more I think that writers can do that, the more satisfying it is for the player because it feels like you're actually figuring it out. You're solving a problem.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. I think it can work that way for like, this kind of ties back a little bit to like quantifying clues and stuff like that. But the idea that if you want, there's knowing more about the world and going and finding these things that will tell you more about the world. And then if you need to know more about the characters, I'm a big believer in kind of, again, I'm going to mention Dragon Age because it's like the most prominent example of the idea that you have this sort of main path thing that has happened with a bunch of characters that you've observed being wacky, being weird, whatever. And the character, the player's curiosity about a character that was in that scene motivates them to go in the whatever space that you're in and poke that character and get that kind of extra flavor text that you wouldn't otherwise get. Whereas someone who is not curious wouldn't do so. Like as a specific example in Dragon Age Inquisition on my second playthrough, which I mean, it's been out forever, spoiler alert, still, whatever. After I knew starting a new playthrough that Blackwall was not who he said he was and was lying about being this prestigious Grey Warden warrior, I immediately went to him and I was like, hey, what's it like being a Grey Warden? And it was so much fun and really, really cool and insightful to see the kind of ways he wiggled around it and spoke and lied essentially just with such conviction and in a way that works both with someone who knows he's a liar and someone who doesn't. That someone would have found him and been like, after seeing you in this, you know, main path context, I'm going to go and explore further, not because I was told to, but out of curiosity, you get this like very interesting insight about a character you wouldn't have otherwise.
What an excellent way to create replay value too. I love that kind of thing. I haven't played it in the sense that I've actually played it. I've played it in that I've watched my partner play it. We're both in the games industry, and that's sometimes how we do things. It's like, we don't have time to play everything. So like, you play this, you tell me when it's exciting. But I ought to play it properly. And yeah, they do some great stuff with the character interactions you have going on. Oh, and sometimes I feel like, maybe just because I have recently made a time loop game, I'm like, man, to like fully experience all the different possible angles of this story, I either have to play, you know, I want it to be a time loop essentially so I can keep going back and trying new things. And then I realized that's just replaying the game. You can do that. No one is stopping you.
I want to backtrack a little bit to, I forgot who mentioned talking about endings. So I want to go quickly into
that might have been me.
Yeah, it was.
Probably.
Olivia, what sorry, I might put you on the spot a little with this one. Not intentionally, I promise.
This is a two-part question. Second part is from Kelsey, but what do both of you think makes a good opening and a good ending?
I guess I'll go first. A good opening has to establish the norm. This is a thing with games I've noticed specifically is that people are like, they want to get rid of the norm as fast as possible because conflict usually, like the conflict comes in and it changes what the norm is. And that is usually intrinsically tied with what the combat or the gameplay, that kind of thing. So they want to get rid of the norm as fast as possible. Yeah. Business as usual. We know, let's go. Conflict is more compelling when you know that it is abnormal. Adventure is only adventure because it is not your day to day. And how do you know what the day-to-day is unless you take some time to establish it? So for me, an opening is really important. Also, depending on what you're doing. If you're doing like a situation where like that starts
when the conflict is already happening, it's up to narrative direction, of course, but I'll usually say that any good opening at least takes enough time to establish what is normal so that what is not normal, the problem, can stand in starker contrast and actually be more impactful to the player. A good ending, I might as well just do one, 1-2 punch maybe.
Sure.
I kind of want to talk about Steven Universe.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm yeah. always down to talk about Steven Universe.
Steven Universe is a wonderful show on Cartoon Network, and I think it's brilliant for a lot of reasons. It is a cartoon, it's not a video game, but I think about it a lot in terms of how, in its most recent two endeavors, it has had a movie that's come out recently, and it had a season finale out recently. Oh yeah, it did.
I totally forgot the movie. Genuinely, I'm so sorry to do this, but please don't spoilers.
Okay, I won't. I'll only talk about one, I'll talk about them.
The series totally fine. I've seen all of it. It's all good.
Okay, have you seen Change Your Mind? Yes. Right?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, they had two instances as a production, as a team. The team that made Steven Universe has essentially made, in succession, two instances that could have been the series finale. They were both so encompassing of all of these world-building rules that they had set up throughout the entire series, all of the accumulation of the growth that the characters have experienced over the series, and about the very theme, from the very theme of who the protagonist was at the beginning to the end, was so wonderfully, like, I feel like wrapped up as a phrase is like too reductive as to how they did it, mainly because, you know,
does interwoven feel better?
Yes, absolutely it does. That's a much better word. The idea that, like, fundamentally the protagonist has in a way that is very digestible to children, this huge crisis as to who he is, and this huge kind of mantle to carry this intergenerational kind of trauma, sins passed down kind of thing that he has to deal with, and all of it is sort of teetering on this thing. It's like, oh, I guess that's who I am. Who I am is the product of all of these problems. And the finale kind of says, no, you're not. You're you. And the idea that in a microcosm of what the story is itself, and that as a lesson for a viewer, is so great. So an ending has to be aware of everything that came before it. And if there's a twist ending, it still has to be aware of everything that came before it. It does.
Maybe
there's
doubly
a way to write,
so, honestly.
Yeah.
I really do hate when a twist happens and you're like, that was just kind of
LOL,
added in there,
random,
like,
XD. Like, yeah. It's
plan your twist, damn it.
Yes. So, a good ending is the multiple endings that Steven Universe could have and still isn't. They're not even done yet. It's so wonderful. Anyway, a good ending is something that keeps tabs on everything that came before in a cohesive way.
Good answer.
Go ahead, Kelsey.
Yeah. Well, what do I start with? The beginnings or the endings? I don't know which to speak to first, since I have some kind of responses, I suppose. But
up to you.
You should go backwards. Do like a palindrome kind of thing.
Be real spicy about it. Yeah. I'm a little less technical about a good ending. A good ending, I think, is something that, like, when I'm writing one, it feels good in my bones. I'm like, yep, that's it. That's it right there. It's addressed the main themes that have been brought up in the game. It's reflecting back to those big storytelling moments. It's kind of encompassing, having these beats that kind of encompass who these characters are and who they've evolved to be. I don't think it has to necessarily tie everything off precisely. In fact, I think I like it better when there's still kind of what happens next vibe to it, or just kind of being left with, I don't know, maybe like when something just doesn't have a definitive answer and the ending is like, well, we're answering this the best we can, but, you know, it's kind of an ongoing thing. Just acknowledging that is, I think, it can be really powerful. So I love it when you turn a game off, you finish a game and you turn it off and you're just like, what an experience.
Yeah.
I think with games in particular, if they can kind of acknowledge the journey as a whole without it being, you know, like your life flashing before your eyes. I'm not saying literally like that, but if you're kind of hitting those key character moments and those key themes in your ending, then I think that's pretty ideal. The one that stuck with me the longest, weirdly enough, is Ocarina of Time's ending. Just that freeze frame with young Link and young Zelda kind of meeting again, quote unquote. I don't know. I love that moment because it left me with a few questions as a kid. And I think that's kind of what sticks with me is if an ending kind of leaves me with a few questions still. In terms of beginnings, what Olivia is describing in terms of establishing the ordinary world before venturing into the special world. I mean, that is step one of for Vogler, Vogler. I never know how to say that. I'm self-trained. Can you tell? is it, which, how do you guys say that?
I want to say Vogler.
I think it's Vogler, but I'm not sure.
Okay, cool. I've been saying Vogler and now I'm like, but we'll go with that confidently now. It's step one for Joseph Campbell. It's honestly a step one for that, yeah. Dan Harmon's 8-point story signal circle. And it's so important. And weirdly, I think I love beginning in media res. Like I really do. I like giving the player something weird, being like, here's the situation you're in. Like, you know, figure that out. But at the same time, I think some games are trying to get to the action too quickly. I'm not saying begin in the middle of necessarily the inciting incident, even. I love beginning after the inciting incident and giving the players some space to be like, okay, I have to figure out what's going on here. And as they do, they're kind of learning more about the ordinary world first, and then they're learning about what it is that's changed that's resulted in what you're about to experience. So I think it is kind of the case sometimes that we games as a whole try to begin a little too in the middle of the action. And it kind of it's jarring because you're doing the double work of trying to figure out what it is the special world is and what the rules are for that. And then also trying to figure out the ordinary world at the same time. That's a tall task. I also think the opposite sometimes happens where you've got, you know, I'm not going to slam the Star Wars, title crawl because no, but I am going to say in a game, I don't love the like blessed token, like rest in peace, dude. But Jesus Christ, fantasy writers love doing the thing now where they're like, no, centuries ago, the Thorin the Elder, the first of his kind and his brothers all waged war and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm like not related to any of those people. And also I don't care. Please get to the point. So I don't like it being like a history lesson. That's setting the bar pretty low. But I love being given freedom right away. I like being able to explore on my own. I don't like the immediacy of, I don't want to immediately have to dive into the action necessarily. And I don't want to be led around by a character being like, okay, go do thing A. We're going to do this first. All right, here's your gun. Here's how you're, you know, here's how to use it. I know that's necessary, but I think I'm just a real fan of like diegetic storytelling in general, where you're learning how to use a gun on the fly. Mm-hmm. And because I'm talking in such broad terms, I do have an example. Have you guys played Untitled Goose Game?
Not yet.
Not yet.
It is a treasure. Oh my God.
Oh man.
It's so good. It's so good. The storytelling in it is just phenomenal. So the beginning of Goose Game is really good. It gives you a setting.
No spoilers?
No spoilers. But it gives you a setting, and then it introduces your character in a way that's just completely in tone. You know exactly who you are right off the bat, or you know who your goose is, so to speak. I don't know. It lets you embody the role just immediately. And I know that's not always relevant because sometimes you're more of a blank slate character than you are a specific one. But in either case, just having a moment that kind of right off the bat gives you an idea of who you are or what you're doing or what you're about, I think that's a really strong way to get things started. Don't make me guess at all that stuff. Give me something right away. Ideally something visual. You know, what am I working with here?
Yeah. We just started this last episode, but we're stealing it from the AV Club.
So think of this question in the back of your head, and we're asking other questions after this, but what is one storytelling question you would like our next podcast guest to answer? And then in the meantime, from our last episode, Sam Meggs wanted to ask, outside of video games or your job, what is one thing that you're trying to master right now?
I'm trying to become a better dungeon master. I'm trying to make a better, more fun, more challenging D&D campaign for my friends. It's really up there. D&D is a confluence of a lot of things I love. It's a confluence of non-linear styles of writing.
What rules are you playing?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Sorry. Genuinely, I was curious what rule set you're playing as a dungeon master.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said it super quietly and weirdly, so no worries.
We're playing 5th edition, and I'll be honest, it's the only edition of D&D I've ever played. But from what I hear from certain people who've played other editions, they're like, yeah, it's pretty tight.
It really is solid. I would also accept like 4.5. Not that my approval means anything.
I'm glad you want it.
I'm not your dad.
Yeah, it's a confluence of so many things I love. Writing, improv, performance, and also friendship. It is, to make friends as an adult is quite a thing, and I'm in that it's like, you guys aren't in an institution, you're not in a school, and maybe you don't necessarily want to make friends at work, so where do you make friends if not inside an institution? You make your own institution of Dungeons and Dragons. I don't think I'm bad at it, but I think I want to get better at it because it is so fun when it works. It is so fun when everyone's engaged. It's so fun when there's dramatic irony dripping all over everything because you know what's about to happen and none of your players do. Oh, it's a rush. And I just want to be good at it. I just want to be good.
That's a noble goal, because I find that really hard sometimes as a writer, bizarrely. I don't like reacting in the moment. I like having time to think about it for a hot minute.
Honestly, I think I do prefer that sometimes, because it's like, my reaction will certainly be a reaction, but I don't know if it's going to be good. And if I have time to sit down and think about it and write it out, there's more of a chance that it will be good. But also, life is short.
Yeah,
you have you better just freaking improv this thing right now, because all your players are looking at you.
It helps so much to have those kind of mythological archetypes to reach for, especially in terms of just, you know, fantasy. I'm sure you've read a lot of it. I know I have, and you've got a lot of the, you know, repeating themes and quests and all that kind of thing. So that helps. Mm-hmm. I do love playing a character. That's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, and the tropes, the known fantasy tropes thing helps, because you can also subvert them, because you know everyone at the table knows.
Right.
Them.
No, that's so critical in storytelling. Just being able, knowing the rules of your genre, and then playing with those accordingly, because you know your player is probably going to react in particular ways to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. That's like, what's, it's such answer, a Kelsey? Good narrative tool. Oh, skateboarding. I'm learning how to skateboard.
Oh,
mastery,
nice.
Is a noble goal, but I would call it for competency. I'm trying to learn how to walk the dog, which is a skateboarding trick that is not difficult if anyone listening is familiar with skateboarding. Yes, I am a poser, and I'm doing the best I can. I thought it'd be easier because I used to play roller derby, and I thought my center of balance and all everything was good. But like, it's just, you move so differently on a skateboard. It's weird.
Yeah, when you can't move both feet in a certain way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like weirdly changing how I'm experiencing, like, even just my driveway. It made me so much more aware of like what my pavement is like, and like what the slope of it is, and just, I don't know, it's kind of cool. I want to eventually be able to, you know, skateboard around on it, like to places. That is the dream. I'm too old for this possibly, but also, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
I'm also trying to learn how to watercolor. I do a lot of like paint marker-y stuff, art stuff, and it's just not something I've really messed with. And all of the stuff I like that I've done, I've created by accident. So that's probably so a metaphor of some kind.
God.
That's cool. I will not skateboard because I'm too tall.
Oh, how tall are we talking?
6'4". My center of gravity is way too high for me to walk to the skateboard.
Are you both 6'4"?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Honestly,
imagine if one of them wasn't, how torn up they'd be.
I used to be taller
like when I was 10 for a few years, then we evened out.
I would be so competitive about that. Oh my God. Yeah, it's a good thing my brother and I are not twins.
It's all right. It's not bad.
We do not need to get into it right now.
No, but I am asking how tall you are in case Alex and I ever need to like challenge you guys to a fight or something to establish, you know,
okay,
like dominance in the industry.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's we'll a thing lose. People do.
You're the East Coast, we're the West Coast.
For now. Well, he's West Coast actually, so.
Oh shit, we gotta go fight him.
I know. Well, not without me. shit on the tank.
So from the last episode, Kate Tremblay's question she wanted to ask was, what media, games, books, etc., best represents the thing that you want to do with your writing?
I was actually kind of curious about this one. Do you mean like a specific work or a format?
You choose how you're going to interpret the question.
Because if it's format, I'm going to say games, and that's going to be a terrible answer.
That's the easy answer.
Well, maybe my answer will inspire. I know I literally already mentioned it, but it's On the Brain.
Steven Universe.
Yeah. mainly because a friend of mine gave me one of the art books as a gift, and I poured through it, and there's somebody like wrote it and interviewed members of the team and Rebecca Sugar, the showrunner, and things like that. And her philosophy as a showrunner and how she lifts up and encourages specific things of the people on her team and what that has produced, i.e. a sci-fi fantasy that is familial, progressive, hugely empathetic, and like aesthetically beautiful, that ticks a bunch of boxes for me. The idea that, I mean, I don't know, I'm not, God willing, it was a good production to be a part of. managed by someone I admire that puts a net good into the world and has a really tight narrative in terms of both story and character progression. That is something I would love to be a part of. I'm already, like, as after I poured through that book, and I plan to get the next one when it comes out, I'm always taking notes on basically the different ways that you are allowed to produce something, the different ways that you're allowed to have a messy sketchbook, and the different ways that you can lift up the people around you, whether they are lateral to you, below you, above you, that kind of thing. The idea that everyone's well-being and the collective thing you're working on is more important than your own ego.
That's a good answer.
Thanks.
Kelsey, do you have one?
Yeah, maybe a couple. It's not that I especially want my work to be like something else, though. It's more I admire qualities about them. And I think so far I've produced some work that's true to that. But game-wise, Night in the Woods is a huge one for me. I absolutely adore that work. And kind of a similar thing, Overqualified. It's an epistolary novel by Joey, I want to say Kumau. I don't really quite know how to pronounce that. They're just very emotionally honest things in ways that you almost wouldn't expect, especially for Night in the Woods, you almost wouldn't expect to work quite that well in the forum, because they're about specific experiences that it's unlikely anyone's had those exact experiences. And yet it's so easy to step into those roles and to put yourself in there. They're just incredibly emotionally honest works. And they're also they've still got sharp edges to them. It's not necessarily this perfect, polished thing. It's not maybe, like, even they would go back and change things. But I don't know. There's something about that. There's something about there being sharp edges still in there that you can cut yourself on a bit, that you're experiencing this just broad range of emotion, that certain things in it are going to be uncomfortable or sit weirdly with you, and you're going to be thinking about it after you put it down. I really value that. And this is this is like grossly self-congratulatory, so I'm really sorry in advance, but we have had a few people respond with Outer Wilds. There's like an article, it's on, I think, Kotaku, but we've got the responses I value the most are the really personal ones, where people have said like Outer Wilds has been useful for them in coping with like thoughts about just existence and kind of the broader
concepts of life and death. And it's like, holy shit, first of all, to have made something to inspire that kind of response is a bit, honestly, it's a bit terrifying, because it's like, I'm going to have to write a garbage game next deliberately just to like get over the fear of not living up to that. But no, just it's, I really appreciate works that kind of are making me think about the world and not even just questioning my belief, but affecting it. You're coming away from something. And maybe that's a good ending. Is a great ending is where you're coming away from it, from that story. And it's impacted your worldview in some way. So, I mean, that's stuff I admire just in a lot of different things that I love, but it's such a broad, it's such a broad answer that it's hard to narrow it down to one incredibly precise book. I don't know. I just love that combination of very honest humor with kind of the blunt terror that sometimes exists in life in weird ways. So that's some cool kind of answer anyway.
No, it's great.
Yeah. So then now what question would either of you ask our next guests we're going to have on next month?
I think I have one. It might need a bit of preamble, so I'm going to try to phrase it as best I can so it's like one line long. In the early 2000s, late 1990s, there was like an academic debate between game studies academics, which was games are about like mechanics and games are about narrative. And the truth is that they're about both. That's why it's kind of no longer a debate anymore, is because everyone, for the most part, kind of agrees that a good game has both a balance of narrative and mechanics. And this kind of mindset comes from the idea that like, oh, time to stop the gameplay and watch a cinematic. And we don't have that as much anymore these days. It's blending together faster and faster. So I would ask the next people on the podcast, what game have you seen or experienced that is the closest thing to that blend? What is the game that you have played that is the closest balance between narrative and gameplay? Not even balance though, but like the blending of the two as seamlessly as possible.
Oh my right. God, is yeah. there a word for that? Because I keep describing it as having very interwoven story and
seamless
gameplay.
Seamless is pretty good.
Seamless is, I think, as close as we're going to get. Like, I bet maybe. You if someone made up a horrific portmanteau, like ludonarratology.
It's not going to have the word ludonarrative like, in it. I'm so sorry. You've used it several times in very, very good ways, but I still kind of hate that word. It makes me feel douchey.
Oh, it's awful, and I apologize retroactively for using it. It's absolutely the worst.
It completely got your point across. It exists as a word for a reason.
No, it is like a borderline pretentious word. That is, you can call me out on that. That is A-okay.
No, it wasn't even meant to be a call out, because I'm going to ask a real pretentious question.
Let's hear it.
So I've been reading a lot lately, just, I don't know, just some books about games that I've heard a lot about and I haven't gotten around to. And I'm finally doing that. So hooray for reading. And Anna Anthropy, in her book, Rise of the Video Game Zinesters, defines video games as an art form in the way that as a painting conveys what it's like to experience the subject as an image, a game conveys what it's like to experience the subject as a system of rules. That was really interesting to me. And I don't have an answer to how would you or why would you define games as art? And I'd love to hear someone else's thoughts on that. Probably someone smarter than me that can make that make sense. Because, hell, I'm kind of still in the like pornography definition of I know it when I see it.
These will be interesting answers to hear next month.
Yeah, is that a vicious question to ask someone though?
No.
Because
no.
Like if somebody had asked me before, like Sam asked such a good, kind question about non-video game things, and now I feel like a jerk.
No, we are pretty confident of who we're going to have on next month, and this will be fun answers to get out of them.
Oh, wonderful.
Ooh.
But that'll be it for the show. Where can people find you on the internet if you want to promote your social media?
You can find me on Twitter at oyassialex. That's O-Y-A-S-S-I Alex. It's mostly mostly my opinions and things like that, but I do post a lot of stuff about stories and what I'm up to, and people can certainly follow me there.
I am also on Twitter, shockingly, I know, as at Van Kelsing. It's like Van Helsing, but with a K in it, because again, I used to play nice. Roller Derby.
Is that your roller
it
derby
is.
Name?
It is! My little That's sister phenomenal. Came up with it.
Oh, I'm so angry. It's so good.
I know. I was furious because it was much more clever than anything I had come up with. And I'm like, I'm going to go with that. But,
but it's also associated with your own name. The best thing I could come up with was Marissa Tomayhem.
Oh, that's great. That's
really good.
But that has nothing to do with me. I'm not Marissa Tomei.
No, that's solid. There was a girl that I didn't skate with her. She was in the junior league, who is Nancy Drew Blood. And that was nice. That was pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, all my stuff's on there. I make a lot of dumb jokes. I don't know why anyone follows me, but that's a thing you can do if you're so inclined. And it links to like a lot of my other stuff in general. I have a place for like projects and I don't know. I'm on Instagram, but I'm not even going to say that one just because it's all pictures of cats all the way down. It's what I use the internet
hey,
for.
Man. There's always a market for pictures of cats.
They're very handsome cats.
And you can find this podcast Twitter at ScriptLockCast. And our music was done by Lily Nishida.
No, our art was done by Lily Nishida.
Our art was done by Lily Nishida. And our music was done by Isabella Ness. And that's it. Thank you both so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having us. This is a lot of fun.